It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Chaos in Venezuela's capital, Caracas, on Tuesday. A police helicopter circling the city, firing shots at the Interior Ministry and dropping 4 grenades on the Supreme Court. President Nicolas Maduro says the attack is part of an attempted coup, ratcheting up the country's violent political crisis.
I have activated the National Armed Forces, and I am sure that sooner or later we will capture those who have launched this armed terrorist attack against the institutions of our country.
The government says the helicopter was stolen by police pilot Oscar Perez. A video uploaded to his social media account around the same time saying an operation is underway to restore democracy.
Venezuelans, dear brothers, we do not speak for the state. We are a group of military officials, police and civilians in the search for balance against this criminal government.
The attack came as drama broke out at Venezuela's National Assembly, where 24 lawmakers say they were mobbed by pro-government gangs. Maduro has faced 3 months of protest by an opposition that's branded him a dictator and accused him of wrecking the economy. The violent unrest has so far left at least 75 people dead and hundreds injured.
All right, that's a report from the BBC, and that gives you just a taste of the chaos that is Venezuela. We have covered Venezuela's situation from time to time in this last 2 years that I've been on the air here with various experts, and we've watched its demise under Hugo Chavez. And so it's time for us to turn our attention back because the people of Venezuela are just crying out. In fact, I had the privilege of being in a meeting yesterday with several, three, who had just come from Venezuela telling their stories. And so I've asked one of them to join us this morning. But first, before I introduce our Venezuelan guest, I will introduce Paul Coyer, who's become a friend. He's a research professor at the Institute of World Politics, and he's helped me put this together this morning. So I wanted to say hi to you, Paul.
Hi, thank you for having me.
But the interesting thing, the twist on your bio, of which there's a whole lot more than what I said, is that you have a Venezuelan wife.
Correct. My specialty is Eurasia, Russia, China. Never thought I'd specialize or learn more about Latin America. It's always been interesting to me. And then I married a Venezuelan girl. And when you do that, you marry the whole culture. And it's given me a love for that culture and a heartbreak for what's happening in the country.
Well, of course, and now they're, because of the entanglement of the Soviet Union, now Russia, in South America and other countries, it's really not that strange. I would imagine that your knowledge of Russia has helped you understand what's going on in Venezuela.
There's a lot of parallels. And China as well.
Yeah.
Authoritarian or autocratic systems have a lot of commonalities.
Right. Tell me about your wife. Did you meet her in Venezuela, or did you meet her here?
No, we met in Northern Virginia. Part of my first degree was voice. I sing as well. I have a musical background, and she is a violinist. She has a doctorate in music. She teaches at a college in Maryland and is concertmaster for the National String Symphony here in Washington, D.C. We perform together occasionally. We met at an Irish pub after a church choir rehearsal.
Drinking Diet Coke, right?
That's exactly right. We're Episcopalians, no.
All right, so Paul, describe for me, she has family still there in
Correct.
Venezuela. Well, describe their life right now. What's happening with them?
Some of them luckily live in rural areas. I don't want to give too many details for obvious reasons, but the ones that live in rural areas are lucky enough to have chickens, goats, cows, so they can make their own cheese, their own milk, their own eggs. Because, as you, I'm sure, know, food is very scarce. One study showed people lost 19 pounds on average in 2016, and I think Enrique was telling me that it was over 10 in the first 5 months of this year alone, right? So it's very bad. But her family is just surviving. One cousin was killed in early May in some of the mayhem there. As we know, Caracas is, the single highest homicide rate in the whole world. Mm. A study also came out last year, I think, by Pew, that it was a study of 2016 of attitudes towards your own feelings of security in your country that showed that Venezuelans' feelings of insecurity were higher even than Syrians, which tells you how atrocious the situation is.
Paul, yesterday you put together a briefing that I had the privilege of attending, and you have been, I don't know, in your home, or you've been being host to three Venezuelans who are here to tell their stories. And one of them has agreed to join us this morning, and I'm going to let you introduce him, okay?
Okay. Enrique Altimare has become a good friend, especially over the last few days that we have hobnobbed together throughout Washington, D.C. We have had the privilege of meeting with a number of people that he can tell you more about that are sympathetic to the fight for democracy in Venezuela. He is trained in the law and is finishing up a master's degree in England in political philosophy. He has a background in philosophy and political science, is incredibly articulate in English and in Spanish, and he has a bit of a Venezuelan/British accent, which is kind of rare, which I enjoy listening to.
We're going to find out. Enrique, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sandy, and thank you very much, Paul, for that introduction as well.
Enrique, why did you come here?
Why did I come to Washington?
Yeah, why? What's your mission?
Basically because in Venezuela we need as much help as we can get. The situation is awful in the sense that the opposition doesn't have any kind of democratic or institutional avenues to conquer democracy again. And in that sense, the help of the United States and the help of the region, of the countries of the region, is incredibly important. It's a sine qua non kind of requirement if we are going to have a democratic transition at any point, actually. And in that sense, the role that the United States plays and that this administration has taken is just not only supportive, it's not just a change of attitude, it's also that we want to this to be concrete and to be able to actually help in practical ways for our transition to democracy.
Yeah. Enrique, as Paul mentioned, you are a student, graduate student at the University College in London.
It's actually King's College,
King's
London.
College London.
I got
yes.
that wrong
Is
when
it King's
I first
College?
Sent you the email, yes.
Yes. Which king? Oh, I'm kidding. So many to choose from. All right, so there you are in Europe, you know, Europe of sorts, in England, in London. So you're with young men and women your age, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And I don't know about that college, but I do know about America. And I know that our young people, your age, are absolutely, it seems, consumed with the notion that socialism is just a great, marvelous new discovery of theirs, that Bernie Sanders is a savior. Bernie Sanders, who spent his honeymoon in the Soviet Union with his wife when they were enemies of this country, who knows full well what revolution means, that it means death and destruction in the streets. They think that's fascinating. He is their champion. Boys and women, young women, your age, coming from the homes where they should know better, are totally enamored of this. So you find yourself in this college. Are you shoulder to shoulder with young people who think this way? And how is that working out?
I mean, I don't know about the burn, but I definitely know that in England, a lot of people think that Chavez was a good guy, that he was a guy that just loved the poor people, that he wanted the best for the country, and that Venezuela has a crisis, an economical and political crisis, only because the oil prices are low, well, relatively low, and that is the reason why this government is failing, and that is a completely wrong interpretation of the situation, and that actually is just, I would say, fundamentally wrong. It's radically wrong. In the sense that the reason why we are at the stage we are at in Venezuela is because all of this was in one way or another designed, engineered. Poverty is the strategy of the government to have more power, over the people that need subsidies, that need the help of the state, to have a state that is massive in the sense that it's in charge of rice production, pasta production, toilet paper production, and that's why we have shortages of pasta, of rice, of toilet paper, and so on. So it's very difficult for me actually to explain the situation, because people, a lot of times, they want balanced opinions. And when you're talking about these guys, the balanced opinion is just, I mean, if you want the truth, I will tell the truth, but then don't expect me to find or to think really hard to find some positive claims about the government, because otherwise I will be completely just subjective, or I would lack, I don't know, some kind of reasonable standpoint. And that is just not true.
Yeah, it's funny how intellectuals seem to think that the more confusion they express over an issue, the brighter they are. They always seem to think that clarity is a sign of a low IQ. You know,
exactly.
I've
spent so many years in academia at schools like Yale and the London School of Economics and Political Science, and it's ridiculous.
But isn't it true,
exactly,
Paul?
True.
They go, you just don't, somehow your IQ is not very, if you see it clearly,
exactly,
there's something wrong with you. So,
well, I would say that that's a problem of the students, actually. But as soon as you go up, you realize that the intelligent people, the good scholars, are the ones that are clear about things.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, Britain has had their wrestling match with socialism. And yes. I don't know how far back it goes, but it certainly goes back to the time of Winston Churchill. It was the socialists who got him out of office. Very other things, too, but... it was the battle about socialism, and Margaret Thatcher faced that battle and sort of pulled England back. So really, honestly, your voice, I'm just saying, don't be quiet. I imagine they need to hear from you, and so do our young people. All right, let's go back to Venezuela, though, because that's where your heart is. I know it is. Your family's there.
Yes.
Tell me about your life. Tell me about your dad, your mom. What's your life? Not the particulars of this situation yet, but just what does your dad do?
Okay, so my dad was a lawyer and an entrepreneur. He died 3 years ago. And he actually, this is something really interesting. He used to have a company that used to produce just public lighting equipment. And of course, when you work with public lighting, you work mainly with the government.
Public lighting?
Lighting, yes, lighting.
Lighting,
I'm
okay.
Very sorry.
That's all right. No, I'm just trying to make sure.
My bad, yeah. Sorry.
You missed one word. How dare you?
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically, he used to work a lot with the government, but then he signed against the government to go for a referendum. And the government called him and they said to him, you need to put away your signature.
This is under Chavez.
Under Chavez, yes, mm-hmm. 2003, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. If you don't put away your signature, then you will have no more contracts. And he didn't. He didn't put away his signature, like he kept his principles. And then he went bankrupt, basically, in part because of that. So that's just one example.
That was your dad.
That was my
dad. Let's just sit on that
yes.
for a second. How old yes. were you when that happened?
I was probably 11 or 12 years old.
So you yeah. saw your dad do that?
Yes.
Other
yes.
brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have 5 siblings, actually. And most of them are outside Venezuela. They basically flee as soon as the situation got worse and worse. Progressively, we've been helping each other. My first sister went out of the country in 2002, and she's been helping one by one to go out of the country, trying to get some kind of sense of future. I have one brother there. My mom still lives there. A lot of uncles, aunts, well, family in the end. But last year, for example, my grandmother, who is 88 years old, after 87 years in Venezuela, moved to Panama. Because there is a shortage of medicines, and my aunts were very worried about her not being able to find her medicines. So they took her to Panama, and of course she's not happy at all. She misses her country. She is from my hometown, and yeah, it's incredibly sad. So,
all right, my guest is Enrique. Hang on a second. Enrique Altamari. And, oh gosh, Paul Coyer. And I'm so pleased you guys are here. I really appreciate it. We're just starting. We have not even scratched the surface of what's going on in Venezuela. I want to ask you when we come back, Enrique, if you remember what it was like before Chavez really got his grips on the country and how things began to change. And then we'll eventually move up to the way things are now. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
First day of protests. It all started on Tuesday when opposition leaders started protesting against the decision by the government to essentially take the legislative powers out of the Venezuelan National Assembly and take them into their own hands. And then to complicate things even more, a very popular opposition leader, Enrique Capriles, was told by the government on Thursday that he was banned from doing any political work. It would be similar to here in the United States, Bernie Sanders being told by the government that because his position is opposite, he is barred from doing any political work for 15 years. And the images that we're getting from Caracas are very, very violent. We see the Venezuelan National Guard clashing with protesters in some of the major thoroughfares around the Venezuelan capital. The National Guard has been using, as you see in these images, canisters of tear gas and also water tanks to fight the protesters. And again, this is not only happening in the capital, Caracas, but in some other cities throughout the country. And to make a little bit of history, Venezuela has been suffering from shortages of the most basic food products and medicines, and people are very angry and they demand a change in government. But the government of President Nicolas Maduro says that they were democratically elected and they are not about to go anywhere anytime soon, Anna.
All right, that's a CNN report, an excellent report, actually, pretty accurate. And we're talking about Venezuela. And it's hard to hear what's going on there without having your heart broken to see what's happening with the people. My guests are Paul Coyer, again, he's a professor at the Institute of World Politics, and Enrique Altamari, who's a graduate student at the King's College in London. Young guy, his family is, he grew up in Venezuela, he was just telling us the story, and by the way, Paul's wife is Venezuelan, so that's the connection there if you just tuned in. Enrique, you were then a young man when your dad made a very courageous decision not to back down in his criticism of Chavez. And as a result of that, he lost his business, and then he lost his life. Did he die of natural causes?
Yeah, natural causes. Yeah.
But you were young when he died,
right? Yeah, I was 21 years old.
Yeah. Yes. All right, so how about your mom? Is she still there?
Yeah, my mom is still there. She's traveling, basically visiting my siblings as well, and in Venezuela, so she's changing locations. She's retired.
All right, so you were young when Chavez took power, and
yes.
Chavez's idea, listen, I remember talking to Alejandro Exclusa Peña, does that ring a bell? Peña Exclusa. Alejandro Peña Exclusa.
Okay, yes.
Yes. Well, I used to talk to him a lot about Venezuela, and he is the one who explained to me that what the Sao Paulo Forum did after the Soviet Union broke up, and they were the ones who had gone into Central and South America and were stirring the people up and moving them to Marxism, that the Sao Paulo Forum was convened by Castro. And the new method of taking over was not through violence, but through the democratic system, to work through the Constitution, get elected constitutionally, and then start shutting down private business, control the courts, and take power, and then declare yourself a dictator, change the Constitution. That's really what Chavez has done, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It's a massive work of engineering, political engineering, in a very clever way and in a very evil way as well. And he was very successful at it. And I think that the Castros are the ones that were the main advisors of Hugo Chavez. Just as you were describing, he attempted two coups d'etat in 1992. He went to jail. After leaving jail, the first thing he did was going to Cuba. There's a very famous speech in the University of Havana in his first trip. And after that, him or Nicolas Maduro, his close friends, they went to Cuba several times before running for the presidency in 1998. So that is precisely what it happened. They used and abused democracy to destroy it from the inside.
Now, have you learned, Paul, from your wife and her family, and also your own knowledge, of course, is this what you would say to, you watched, isn't
of course.
Chavez,
I mean,
kind
I've,
of
I've written and published about this for Forbes and in other venues extensively. Yes, that's exactly what's happened. And there was a pink tide, as those of us that watch the region call it, from the late 90s with the rise of Hugo Chavez, and it spread to Brazil. You had it in Argentina. You had it, all kinds of places. It's still there in Ecuador, where Lasso, in my view, had the election stolen from him. The socialist former vice president of Rafael Correa, quote-unquote, won. But I think even there, they're facing constraints. The socialists are in Nicaragua. You still have Daniel Ortega. But there was, for all through the first decade or so of this century, they had risen to power to undermine democracy through initially getting elected legitimately and then undermining the institutions.
And that's by contrast of the 60s and 70s. I think it started in the 60s, where they would do these coups, these bloody coups, and they would battles and take over brutally like that through the army. So that's what we're saying.
Yeah, no more so much military juntas, just democratic.
Don't need that takeover. So much anymore.
Exactly.
Just kind of work through the system and corrupt the elections. Yep. And we should know about this, because that's what we're seeing. We are seeing an attempt to do that in this country.
And I should say real quickly that one of the reasons that looks suspicious about Ecuador's election that was recently held, and this shows the pernicious influence of Venezuela throughout the continent, I think three members of the CNE, the Electoral Council, a week before the Ecuadorian election showed up in Ecuador, and Shazam, a week later, the socialists who were not expected to win, won. The Venezuelans are expert at stealing elections, so.
That's true.
All right, well, you are old enough, Enrique, to remember, at least in part, what life was like before Chavez really took power. So when did you really first notice the difference? Was it when your dad did what he did, or what?
No, actually, so we used to have a president, this very old guy, Rafael Caldera, who used to speak. He spoke five languages, a gentleman. He had a very unique kind of ideas, but nonetheless, he was a gentleman. He was a person that you could respect. And I remember watching him talking in a very presidential way with a suit and tie. This sounds very stupid, right? But this is my image. And then this very old guy talking to the nation as the president. Suddenly, this very young guy stopped wearing a suit and tie, started talking in common vulgar language about any kind of things, being in the TV all the time, talking about a lot of different topics. For 8 hours at a time, yeah. And I still remember, I don't know, being 10 or 11 years old and listening to Hugo Chavez talking about the Spoke Zarathustra from Friedrich Nietzsche and how he was completely touched by it, and then talking about Jesus Christ. And after that, talking about what he did when he was a young man and, the soup that his grandmother used to cook for him. And this is the president we're talking about in here. So I immediately saw the difference in the level of the person, in the values, in the way they addressed the nation, and I very rapidly realized that the country was being separated. I mean, you can feel the social engineering even when you are young, because everything started being either red or blue. People started being completely separated.
Did they use those color terms?
Well, Chavez started using the color red, and then everyone else was a different color. But Chavez was red, and whatever wasn't red was like they were the bad guys, basically. So it's this kind of politics of identity where I am this color, and if you are not with me, then you're against me. And very rapidly, I realized that there were a lot of people sacrificing themselves for the country. Chavez always had a very strong opposition. It's not just my dad. With my dad, 2.5 million people signed, and they lost their jobs. 85% of the people working in PDVSA, our oil company, were fired because they went for a strike. There was a total strike in the country for more than 4 months that I lived as well, where we didn't have gasoline. I started using my bike to go everywhere. I couldn't go to the school, and I had to do my homework from my house, like, every day for 4 months. You can imagine that. And that was because we had a strong opposition, and the way Chavez reacted was to ban these people from the country in one way or another, to fire all these people, to use the powers of the state to eliminate his opposition. At least, I mean, when you make the state to grow and to hire a lot of people, so at least 25 or 30% of our workforce work for the government, for the central government.
Sounds familiar.
And he started firing all the people from opposition. He did, actually. So, and you could feel that. I could feel that even when I was very young. Also, my dad was a political activist, so I have to say that I used to watch CNN and BBC since when I was 9 years old.
And you still came out knowing the truth. That's the good part about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, well, no, trust me.
True.
Yeah. Well, so the way I remember Venezuela before Chavez destroyed it, and we're going to get to that destruction, oil, the richest oil supply, I mean, unbelievable oil supplies. You know, the whole world, I remember when I was growing up, our oil companies went to Venezuela, you know, to drill the oil and to get it to the rest of the world. Rich because of your oil, strong Christian influence, strong churches. This is the way I remember Venezuela before Chavez. And
well, I remember it, I mean, at least with my law training, I could read about it, or the way I think about it is a country with separation of powers, where courts of justice are independent, where politicians don't talk about everything, so we were not a totalitarian regime. We had flaws in our political structure, very bad ones or critical ones, but at least the state was not ubiquitous.
Yeah,
it
had
was
freedom
not everywhere.
We had
freedom,
freedom.
As citizens. Yes.
All right. So Chavez then starts to take over the businesses, and he starts to fire people that oppose him.
Well, the first thing he did was to change the constitution. We used to have a democratic constitution. He changed it, and unfortunately, a lot of the people from the opposition today have to quote the constitution, that constitution, and say, "Oh, well, the government is not complying with the constitution." So, look at this sin. I mean, this is horrible. And I mean, more or less, I agree with them. Like, they are not even keeping their own very low standards from the constitution of 1999. But this is a constitution that was already engineered for this kind of movement. I mean, Chavez got, with 55% of the votes back then, 95% of the people actually drafting the constitution. And then the mathematician that designed this strategy, this electoral strategy, got the Central Bank of Venezuela for over 16 years.
So didn't he also write into the constitution that he would be president for life or something? Wasn't that part of it?
Not at the beginning. So in our constitution of 1961 stated that you couldn't go for re-election. Latin America, we are prone to dictatorship, so you could only go to re-election after two periods, and it was actually very well intended, and it worked. In the constitution of 1999, he put a direct re-election and 6 years of term, so 12 years. And then in 2006 and 2007, he started pushing for a permanent re-election, or, I don't know, eternal kind of re-election, endless re-election, and in the end he did, in an unconstitutional way, an illegal way, and of course wrong way, but he did it, yeah.
So then he died, and he appoints his friend, the bus driver.
Yes, Nicolas Maduro, right? The bus driver. Yeah, and the killer. Yeah, he's a student killer. He's killed a lot of students in 2014 and this year. He's a guy with no kind of preparation that is completely disconnected from what is happening in the country. He's isolated, and he doesn't care.
All right, Enrique, so let's talk about, and let me give you a break for a second. Paul, describe for Enrique, just for a second, all he knows, describe for our audience, what the conditions are now, right now in Venezuela.
It's horrible. I wrote a couple of pieces for Forbes. If people want to Google it, you can go to Forbes' website and Google my name in the search box, Paul Coyer, C-O-Y-E-R.
We'll put that on our Facebook page.
Okay, Coyer, and you'll see it. A piece I did in March and a piece I did in April, despite being, you know, 2, 3, 4 months old, they're not actually that dated because conditions are so horrific. And I describe in there how the zoo animals in Caracas are starving to death, how people are killing flamingos because they have no food. You just can't imagine. It's like a real-life Hunger Games. It's difficult to describe.
Is he exaggerating, Enrique?
No, not at all. I could throw some numbers, and then people can interpret it that way. So we are at the top of the list in inflation, over 650% of inflation annually. We are top of the list in murder rate. We have 6 of the 10 most dangerous cities in the world. We have 95% of impunity, so if which is the real number, 350,000 people have been killed in the last 10 years.
350,000
murders. Murders, not deaths, murders. 350,000 murders. 95% of those murders are like go impune. There is no decision,
no penalty.
For them. So if you commit a murder, you have 95% chances of get away with it. We are living, so criminality is in one way or another, or it is a strategy of the government to put fear in the people.
And so chaos, terror. So they can exacerbate and they can spread their control. That's the strategy.
Yes, definitely.
Let me enter, this is a little different, but it's just interesting. I was in Cambodia, maybe 2012, I'm not sure what year it was, but visiting seeing the killing fields, the S-21 prison where the intellectuals were tortured. I'll tell you about that in just a second, because it relates to unpunished murderers and the effect on the country. So I'll tell you that when we come back. My guest is Enrique Altamirano, and also Paul Coyer. And we'll be right back. We're talking about Venezuela. And just giving you the information that you need. We have to know what to do, how to pray, how to feel, how to think, because we are certainly not to look on our own interests, but on the interests of others. That's important. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Earlier, there were more violent clashes between the National Guard and opposition protesters. For more than 2 months, there have been almost daily demonstrations against Maduro's leftist government. Maduro has warned that he and his supporters will take up arms if his socialist government is violently overthrown.
Right, that was a report from Euronews, just a little tidbit of the horrible things happening in Venezuela. And before we took the break, Enrico was telling us that there have been 350,000 murders in the last 3 years, 95% of which have not even been...
In the last 10 years.
And no one has even been brought to justice. 95% of them have not. And I was just telling my guests are Paul Coyer and Enrique Atencio.
No, Altamari.
Altamari. Gosh, I'm so sorry, you guys. My next life, I'll have all these names down better. I was just telling you about a trip to Cambodia, interviewing people, actually former soldiers and people who had survived the killing fields. Enrique, you know what I'm speaking about. It was after Vietnam, after the Americans pulled out, and the Khmer Rouge, the communists loved that color, you know. I guess because of the blood that they shed. But they killed so many of their own people, just horrible, and they called it the killing fields, and then they put the intellectuals in this prison and tortured them. My point is that I had it shared with me that there was depression in Cambodia, and one of the reasons they said there was so much depression was because no one was ever brought to justice.
Yeah, there's a...
And so people were living alongside of people who had killed family members. They were separated, like you're describing, the enemies of the state, and the Reds killed the others, and then nothing was ever done about it. And the effect it had on the culture was just deadly, and that's kind of what you're describing.
Yeah, the effect on the culture is awful in the sense that people don't just... It's not only that you lack a sense of justice, it's that you lack a sense of hierarchies. You stop working hard, you stop believing that through education, hard work, or just being a good person, you have a good life. And instead, you start doing whatever you can to get away with things. Not to work, not to put effort in things, and basically to have resentment to the people that through hard work get good things.
Interesting.
So it's the lack of sense of justice is not only about going to prison. Mm-hmm. It's also about justice in the little things in life.
Just kills the human spirit. You know, I saw that in Moscow too. I was there before the Soviet Union broke up, and I remember talking to a drunk in the park He told me, we just don't have any hope. We don't have any hope. Wow. Paul, the Organization of American States, you wanted to say something about
that. Say something briefly, that the reason, looking at the broad span, I mean, I'm a historian, so I like to look at the broad span, the long-term perspective, because I think it helps. And the United States relationship with Latin America, we know it's been long. I'll just go back 70 years, back to World War II. We were very concerned about a hostile and extra-hemispheric power, i.e. Nazi Germany, using Latin America, and it did to a certain degree, as a base to attack American interests. So when Nazi Germany was defeated in 1945, we created a network, a bunch of multilateral organizations and agreements like we did, an architecture like we did for the rest of the world. And that included the Organization of American States and a number of other agreements that was meant to inculcate and champion American and Western values, meaning transparency, representative government, free markets, human rights, et cetera, et cetera, institutional capacity. And in my view, the American government has taken its eye off the ball for quite a while down there. President Kennedy had a very good program down there for development. It did not, unfortunately, go as far as he had wanted. George Bush Sr. had some good policy initiatives that did do some good. But since the early 90s, we've kind of let things drop for a number of reasons I won't get into here. But we need to, in my view, the United States needs to use its economic and political and diplomatic muscle in order to shape things in Latin America much more effectively. It's our backyard. I know we've got sexier things to look at in terms of strategic threats on the horizon. We got Russia. We have China with them, at least.
North Korea.
And North Korea. I mean, those are legitimate, huge, huge threats. However, Latin America, we need to keep our backyard safe. And we have Iran and Hezbollah and China and Russia, all with major presence there, all working to undermine American interests, in addition to people like, you know, Hugo Chavez until his death, now Nicolas Maduro, Daniel Ortega, et cetera, et cetera. We need to, I think, raise the importance strategically that Latin America has for us.
Enrique, there are some big dates coming up. One in particular, I think, see if I understood this correctly. The assembly overwhelmingly was won by the opposition, correct?
Yes, yes. We have a supermajority.
But then they now, you said, have not been paid for months. I think you said that yesterday.
They haven't been paid by months. That's not the worst part. The worst part is that they have no power. The Supreme Court of Justice completely removed all the powers from the National Assembly, from our parliament, and de facto they are outside the powers of the state.
There's nothing they can do. So what's the date? July 30th is an important date. Why?
Yes, because Nicolas Maduro... In the middle of these huge demonstrations that we have had for over 3 months with over 90 people being killed, Nicolas Maduro is pushing an agenda. And that agenda is to finish the Cubanization of Venezuela. And the way to do that is to, again, to change the constitution one more time to have a communist, a constitution that basically says that the state is going to be communal, and that this would be the final stage for the end of Venezuela, of what Venezuela used to be. And the opposition is not going to those elections because they're completely rigged from the beginning in a very obvious way. And we need to continue demonstrating. We have these days to continue demonstrating, and we need all the help we can have from the governments of the region, and we need the people to be very clear about this. July the 30th is the day that Venezuela is going to die. Venezuelan state, in one way or another, as you know it, even as you know it, is going to change. And
Enrique, you said something yesterday that I wasn't clear about. I was clear about. You said that they've actually managed create a situation where the military, even though they have Venezuelan families, they live in Venezuela, you would think that they would be so concerned about their own people that they would not do what Maduro tells them to do. And you know, they would protect their own people. But you said they've managed to create a separate culture with the military. Explain that.
Well, this is social engineering. This is like evil people we're talking about in here. Basically, they separated the military from the rest of the society. So they have closed social circles. What does that mean? They go to the same clubs, they marry with each other, they go to the same schools. So the militaries have like a separate, they are separated from the civil society. So they are isolated from these, they're not isolated from the problems, but they are isolated from the people. And in that sense, those degrees of separation make really hard for the opposition to actually talk to people from the military.
That's amazing. Did you say that they are there actual Cubans serving in the military?
Yes.
Or are they Venezuelans?
Yeah. There are actual Cubans, over 60,000 Cubans for sure. Not only in the military forces,
a foreign
but passport
army.
Offices. And they are in control of the electoral board as well. They help with the political police. They are the heads of intelligence of our country. And then you see Nicolas Maduro and Diosdado Cabello going to Cuba at least eight times a year. So every time we have a difficult situation, Maduro will go to Cuba for 1 or 2 days and then come back. So the Cubans are actually the people doing the strategy for this government.
Which is what, of course, we talked about earlier with that Sao Paulo forum, teaching how to overtake and ruin and take over your country through the democratic process, which is really what he was... Alejandra Peña Escusa, who I mentioned before, was trying to say to me, which is what we were seeing, some of the things Obama was doing were mirroring that. It was very frightening. And that's why this is so relevant to us, Enrique. Not that we wouldn't be interested anyway, but I do think that America has come close. And I'm not saying the battle's over. We've sort of pulled back from the brink of that. But we were seeing that same pattern used here. Would you agree, Paul?
Absolutely. My wife's family, you can see this pattern around the world. My wife was actually adopted and raised by Cubans in Venezuela. And when Marjorie was young in 1998, when Hugo ran, she was thinking of voting for him, as were many of her peers, because he sounded so good, like Obama in 2008. Mm-hmm. And Marjorie's parents had been, as I said, Cuban. They fled Fidel in 61 and 62, and they said, no, we've seen this before. It sounds good at the beginning, but it's going to end in tears and blood. And they were right, and she didn't vote for him. But we've seen that in Cuba, we've seen that here, and the left has a common strategy that you can see all around the world. It's very discernible and very easily identifiable.
So, Enrique, with the circumstances they've set up, there really is no way to resist. How can you resist?
No, I think that you're wrong in this, because as I told you
before... I want to be wrong, so that's good news.
As I told you before, we have had a very strong opposition, and the people have sacrificed their lives, their jobs, their safety for just to resist, and... There is a way of resisting, which is being truth to yourself and to the circumstances, and resisting in your conscience. And it may sound stupid for some people, but it is incredibly powerful. It is powerful to see 4 million Venezuelans demonstrating against the repression of a complete state. It is incredibly powerful to see over the years all these people resisting, students, old people, just people from the common society, just standing in front of the government and not giving way to the government to, in a peaceful way, dominate the country. So in one way or another, we are prisoners, but we are prisoners in rebellion. We are prisoners giving the fight. And in that sense, we do need the help of the United States and all the countries of the region, not only about attitude. We are putting our lives
Literally.
Enrique, you mentioned that you mentioned President Trump, but I don't think a lot of people would know what President Trump has said or done in regard to Venezuela. Yeah. It's not been on the front burner. So what has he done?
So basically, under President Trump, very important sanctions were passed, like as legislation. Sanctions against Tarek Al-Aissami, our vice president, who is Syrian national. A very dangerous guy, and Samark Lopez, who is the guy who handles his money, sanctions against the military, sanctions against the justices from the Supreme Court that are completely against the people and that they are the hand of
Can't
of the
imagine
government.
That happening, can you, Paul? Sorry.
No comment.
That's inside bad
so,
joke.
And there is a change of attitude. The issue is that we need this to continue, and the end is not sanctions or helping in the OAS. The end or the objective is to change the government of Venezuela, is to have freedom again. We cannot lose that from our side. The opposition from Venezuela is ready to have the power. We already have 85% of our population. The opposition is united. We have a common strategy. And we just need an opportunity. But against this kind of government, we need all the help we can have to get that opportunity and to save Venezuela.
Enrique, are you going to go back to Venezuela?
Yes, I will go back.
They need him.
Yeah.
I think so. And I want to ask you what I asked you yesterday. How old are you, Enrique?
I am 25 years old.
You know, there's something about, it really does, Enrique. I mean, the good news is that you're a man, you know, you're not a boy. And it's going to take men. It's going to take men with courage, like your dad, who raised men like you, with courage to turn this thing back with God's help. And by the way, one last question here. What is the state of the church or any kind of faith in Christ in Venezuela now?
So, two things. The first thing, I'm going to start with the bad part of the story. Chavez was believed in Santeria. So we are, I would say, I wouldn't be, I'm sorry for the word, but we are infected by Santeria in the country. And there is a lot of Santeria and the high powers of the government. But on the other hand, the Catholic Church, which is the majority of the church in Venezuela, has been very firm, clear, and sincere about the situation since 1999. In 2001, they said that this government had a totalitarian character, and they have been consistent with that release. And they started a very strong opposition to the government many years ago. They're doing a great job, and they are suffering as well a lot.
Well, we wish you nothing but the best and nothing but God's blessing, and we will do what we can on this side of the continent, I guess, to persuade our government under this new leadership to do all they can to help you. Enrico Altamari, our prayers are with you, and Paul Coyer, we'll be talking again, you and I, about other things, but it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for bringing these.
Thank you for having
for
us
Enrique
so much.
To my attention, y'all. God bless you guys.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you all, and I will expect you guys to be praying for the people of Venezuela. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. Mm-hmm.